Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Friday, August 23rd, 2019. I'm Sam Minter, and Yvonne Beau is not with us today. I'd actually planned to have him with us, but he's in Argentina, and we had problems with his connection. But his problems with the connection weren't in me hearing him. They were actually causing problems with us hearing our guest. That's right. You heard me correctly. We had a guest this week. Last week, when we were talking about feedback and what different people said, I mentioned that sometimes people have said, hey, we wish you would do more interviews. Now, people weren't saying that all the time, but every once in a while I'd heard that. And then the night before we were going to record the show, there was a news event that made some headlines. And I immediately thought, hey, wait a second. I think I can get somebody on the show, maybe, who relates to this news event. So I organized the interview. I made some connections, blah, blah, blah. And we were going to do the interview with Yvonne, but then that just didn't work. So you get me doing an interview solo. So now what is this interview? I guess I should jump straight to that. I've been yammering too long already, right? The New York Times article about it. Is titled Electoral College Members Can Defy Voters' Wishes, Court Rules. It was published in the New York Times on August 22nd by Trip Gabriel. It has some details of the story, but the bottom line is there are some court cases that resulted from the faithless electors in 2016. And as it turns out, one of the people who headed up the effort to get the faithless electors to do what they did as part of an organization called the Hamilton Electors is Brett Schifalo, who happens to live in Snohomish County, Washington, where I do, and happens to have run for the same local office for fire commissioner that my wife did in 2017. He got more votes than she did, although neither one of them won in 2017. And this year, they're both running for different fire commissioner positions and have actually been coordinating and talking to each other quite a bit. And so I've met Brett and my wife talks to him on a regular basis. So I asked my wife, hey, can you hook me up with Brett? You think he might do the podcast with me? And so I was connected to Brett. And so basically all of this episode after this introduction is going to be me talking to Brett Schifalo about the Hamilton electors, what happened in 2016 and the court cases that resulted from that and where they are today and what's left in the future. The Electoral College is one of like my interests. I mean, obviously I do electiongraphs.com. And so I'm really into the details of the Electoral College. So this was a real thrill for me. And I really enjoyed talking to Brett. I hope you guys enjoy it too. It does get into the weeds a little bit of everything, but it's actually kind of something important. Yvonne and I were going to potentially come back after the interview and talk about a couple other subjects. But by the time Brett and I were done, I originally thought we were going to talk for just like 15 minutes or something. But we ended up talking for over an hour. And by the time we were done, where Yvonne was in Argentina, it was nearly 2 a.m. So I let Yvonne sleep. And the interview is basically the whole show today. Well, it is the whole show, aside from the intro and me saying goodbye at the end. So in any case, we're going to take a break and then you will hear the interview with Brett Schifalo of Hamilton Electors. We'll take another break at the end of that, and then I'll say goodbye and give you all the contact stuff that I always do at the end. And that'll be the show. So this is a little bit different than our normal show, but please enjoy. Anyway, here's a break, and we will be back with Brett Schifalo of the Hamilton Electors.
Ready for the test, Dracula?
I'm ready.
Frankenstein, then let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
And And so we are now joined by Brett Schifalo. Hello, Brett.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, great to have you. I've actually been interested in talking to you about this, or talking to somebody about this, since the 2016 events. And when this new development happened this week, I said, hey, you know, I actually have a connection now. Maybe I'll invite him on and we can chat. So very good to talk to you. So rather than, you know, I do want to level set everybody before we talk about the new stuff. So rather than me trying to give the history of it, can you tell me your story of the 2016 election, how you got involved, and then what you did over the course of that process?
Absolutely. So I've been involved in local politics for quite a few years. I've attended quite a few caucuses, and everybody always runs for national delegate. Well, I chose at the Congressional District 2 caucus that I was going to run for elector, and I am completely against the Electoral College. So my thinking was, I can go through the process, and then I can come out the other end and use it as an elector who is against the Electoral College to maybe get the word out. So I won that election and became one of the 12 electors for Washington State.
Now, let me ask it before we move on from that. Let me ask a little bit about that process, because you said that you got elected to be an elector at the congressional district level, correct?
Correct.
I actually attended as just an observer the state convention where some additional electors for Washington State were selected. And on this podcast way back then, I made a lot of commentary about observing that process and how crazy it seemed to me, the way in which the electors were actually selected. And I don't know if that's the same as what worked in the congressional district. So can you spend a little bit of time talking about how at the congressional district that process worked of actually selecting the electors?
So most of the time in all the caucuses I've gone to in the last 20 years, the Electoral College, the elector vote is an afterthought. Everybody wants to go to the national convention, and then someone says, hey, we're having votes for electors, and everybody just signs up. Honestly, 3/4 of them don't even know what an elector does. In this case, I had done some research and knew I wanted it. I had some printouts. I had a speech. So there was a sign up, and then everybody got 3 minutes to speak. And it was very orderly. And at the end of that, people got to put in their votes. And the top male and the top female run off for alternate and primary elector. And I had the honor of being elected by the majority of delegates there to be the primary elector, while I believe, I can't remember her name, but a very nice Democratic woman was the alternate for CD District 2. The state is a little more chaotic simply because of the size.
Right.
You've got the entire state worth of delegates as opposed to just one of the 10 congressional districts. So it was certainly chaotic.
Now, I'll tell you, when I was observing the state process, first of all, you said you had 3 minutes to talk. I believe the people running for elector at state had like 20 or 30 seconds to talk.
Yeah, we might have had two. I don't recall exactly.
But you had more time than they did. But also, what your statement about the people voting for it not knowing what they were voting for seemed to be very much true. Like, you had all kinds of people, like, trying to interrupt the process and ask, what are we voting for again? I don't understand. And then people trying to explain what it was. And sometimes those explanations were correct. Sometimes they weren't quite correct. You had a lot of confusion over what could or could not be. In what I observed, there was also, in 2016, it was the, you know, we still had this, you know, Bernie versus Hillary divide was very, very obvious. And we had a number of people who were running for elector who explicitly in their 30-second speeches would say things like, you know, I don't care what happens, I'm voting for Bernie as an elector, no matter what, explicitly. You had other people, you know, making speeches about how that's wrong and no, you're bound and you need to vote the way the election goes and blah, blah, blah. And there was just massive confusion about it. And, you know, I kept saying, because I've spent a lot of time looking at, you know, the Electoral College and various things. You know, I do my electiongraphs.com site where I do election predictions, but also I've spent a bunch of time looking at sort of the oddball scenarios. I've looked at faithless electors before. I've looked at what happens in scenarios where the presidential candidate dies between the election and when the Electoral College votes. Yep. You know, there are all kinds of very interesting scenarios. And the bottom line of all of them is that the electors are actually the people who elect the president. Period, end of story.
100%.
I was just going to say, but people treated this choosing of electors, like you said, it was sort of an afterthought. It was like people didn't understand what they were voting for. These people were giving 30-second speeches. And I'm like, my God, people, you're actually electing the 538 most important people in this entire process.
Except here's the real scary part. Many of the people who are running for elector have no clue what it is.
Yes, I noticed that as well. Voting. Yes, and I definitely noticed that as well. There were a bunch of people who were just like, oh, it's a lot of people thought they were running for delegate.
Yep.
And, they were actually running for elector. And I kept sort of slapping my forehead going, I can't believe this is the process by which the electors are selected. There's got to be something better or more deliberative in such a way because, like, you know, these people ultimately have a huge amount of authority. It's very rarely exercised, and we're going to talk about how you exercise that authority in a minute, but it's very rarely exercised independently. But when push comes to shove, they're the ones who pick the president, and frankly, they can do whatever they want. So when you're picking them, you should actually consider that an important decision.
Except most people, even I, didn't really understand at that point the true discretion I had. Now, I probably knew more about the Electoral College at that point than most of the people there. But after I got elected, and this will move us forward a little bit, after I got elected, I spent 3 months, basically 40 hours a week while having a full-time job, researching the Senate debates, Federalist 68, which is very specific about the Electoral College, the second Article 2 and the 12th Amendment, which also have to do with the Electoral College, and everything else, every case in the history of the United States that had anything to do with the Electoral College. And there's basically two. So I dove in to such a high level. One of the interesting things is, because you say it's crazy the way that happened, and you're right, but guess what? State legislatures are the ones who get to decide how electors are elected in each individual state. But here's the next level, though. Basically every state is given the right to the parties, and all the parties do it differently.
Right.
So do you know how electors in Oregon are selected?
No.
So in the Democratic Party, each congressional district has a chair, and you have to be elected as that chair for that 2 years to be an elector, and you're automatically an elector. Bam. You're a party insider. You're an elector. Mm. In California, the congressmen and women and the senators, if a Democrat won, or the person who got the farthest along is a Democrat, get to just choose random people to be electors. That's why Christine Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's daughter, was an elector. And in New York City, it's a central committee that is all the bigwigs of the Democratic Party. That's why ex-president Bill Clinton was an elector in New York, and the president of the SEIU and the president of the FL-CIO. Two of the only states that do it the way we do is Washington and Colorado, funny enough, where Hamilton electors were started.
And by the way, also, this has changed over history numerous times as well. It wasn't that long ago. I believe the last time was in the late 60s sometime, where there were still some states that actually directly elected electors. You would actually run for elector and your name would show up on the ballot rather than the presidential candidate.
That's kind of true, except that it's the same now. All you're doing, when you voted for Hillary Clinton in Congressional District 2, you were voting for me.
Well, you were you were voting for that slate of electors, and that's but what I'm saying is back as recently as the 1960s, the name would actually directly appear on the ballot without any associated national candidate. You were just electing Bob Smith to be elector. And without them committing to anything whatsoever, you were just saying, I want Bob Smith to be the elector.
In most cases, they were associated. In most cases, there were
some specific Southern states that still did it independently. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, it wasn't like this was common nationwide.
Exactly.
And of course, you mentioned ultimately it's up to the state legislature. They don't have to do it by election either.
No, they don't.
Like, I've made a habit of saying every once in a while that, you know, my actual pet theory is, as long as you're going to have the Electoral College, let's forget about this associated with elections. Let's have a lottery. Like, if I want to become an elector, I put my name in a hat and, like, you know, you randomly select people to be electors. It might actually be more representative than the election. I say that half jokingly, but the bottom line is the state legislature of any state could decide any method whatsoever to pick the electors. The Constitution gives them the ultimate authority to decide however they want. In fact, in 2000, there was some conversation about if the whole lawsuit about picking electors wasn't resolved, the Florida state legislature was thinking about, this never actually came to pass, but was thinking about just passing a law and saying, forget the election, we're going to select the electors.
Yeah, and they could have done that. No problem. Yeah. That would have been constitutional. I will say this, though. Selecting by a hat, given what the founding fathers intended, would be the exact opposite of what they intended. Now, I disagree with the Electoral College. I want to get rid of it. But I also studied it as an insider. And my belief is, as long as it exists, we have to follow the rules. And hopefully we can get rid of it. Now, what the Founding Fathers wanted was a group of people who would be above the fray and would be able to make decisions on their own in case of, in Federalist 68, it draws it out very specifically, in case a candidate that was a demagogue, in case there was a candidate that was unqualified, and in case there was a candidate that was controlled by foreign powers.
Right.
Was the candidate. In fact, that fast forwards us to and
basically to be a deliberative body to decide the president. It wasn't intended originally to be a popular vote of any kind. It was you select just like you select Congress and then they make the laws. Mm-hmm. You were selecting electors and then they pick the president.
Exactly, just like senators back in the day.
Yeah, exactly. They
were chosen by the state legislators. In fact, it's interesting. Those senators being picked by state legislators actually is case law that was very important to the cases we're going to be talking about. Because there was some precedent set by that really helped us out. So do you want me to fast forward to election
night? Yeah. Let's fast forward. You got selected as an elector. You did some studying.
Yep.
And then election night 2016 happened. Then what?
So on the night, I was working nights at the time. So we were all devastated. And I got on the phone with a gentleman named Michael Baca, who was an elector from Colorado, who I'd been talking to for a while. We, you know, just minutia talking about the Electoral College, just how exciting it was, all just random stuff. And we spoke for about 8 hours. The first thing we try to do is, how can we get Hillary in office? Because that's been a big misnomer. There's a lot of people out there who think, I was one of those people who said, I'll just vote for Bernie. Nope. When I was elected, I have every intention of voting for Hillary Clinton.
Okay, I was gonna ask that question. One additional question before you move on.
Yeah, please.
During the process of being certified as an elector, at any point did you make a promise to vote for Hillary Clinton?
Yes.
Now, how did that work? What was the actual mechanism of it? I guess first of all, did you, when you were actually elected as at that the congressional district level, did you make that promise in your 3-minute speech?
What I said, because I was asked a question very specifically, and I said I have no intention of voting for anyone other than Hillary Clinton, which was 100% true.
Okay.
Because I didn't have any idea, first of all, of what electors' responsibilities were in the broader sense that I learned by studying. And second, I had no idea Trump was going to win.
Right.
So, and when I signed the pledge, I had every intention of following through on it.
Now, let me get to that, because you moved from what you said in your speech to signing a pledge. How did that work? Was it signing something that the party gave you when you won, or was it something the state made you sign?
Party.
Okay. So only the party. The state didn't make you sign anything. It was the party.
The party has you sign it. The party then submits it to the Secretary of State.
Okay. And so what does that specifically say?
I don't recall the exact thing, but it was maybe two sentences. And it says, I pledge to vote for the Democratic. It might have said Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And at that point, I had every intention of doing it, and I'm not someone who takes breaking pledges lightly in the least bit. But where I had to make a decision on whether I break the pledge or not came after election night when I was having that conversation with Michael Baca.
Okay, so continue from there.
Yeah, during that conversation with Michael Baca, we did everything we could to figure out how do we get 37 Republican electors to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Mm.
6 hours. We tried every permutation. Is there a state we can get Republicans to vote for Hillary? Is there, you know, honestly, there was no way. And so at that point is, how can we stop Donald Trump? And when we looked at our constitutional responsibilities and our constitutional rights, and we realized the only way we have a chance of doing what the Founding Fathers, we believe the Founding Fathers wanted us to do, and stop Donald Trump from failing on all three points, being unqualified, a demagogue, and possibly controlled by foreign powers, we decided we had to start, and it was decided the night of the election, like 2-3 a.m., that we had to start a group. We had to pledge to Republicans that if they voted for a Republican that wasn't Donald Trump, say a John Kasich, a Mitt Romney, a Colin Powell, a Condoleezza Rice, someone we can all agree that we may disagree with if we're Democrats, but aren't completely unqualified. None of those are demagogues. None of those people are controlled by foreign powers. So I disagree with them on policy, but it's a question of harm reduction at that point. And so Michael Baca and I the next day started putting together Hamilton electors. And very quickly, we had created a 527 under the IRS tax code. We started with some very high-level campaign volunteers and really started rolling. We got on CNN, Fox News, international radio and television to try to get the word out. And our entire point was, Republican electors, we know at least 100 of you hate Trump. We know it. We know it. It's clear. You have the constitutional duty, if you don't believe he's qualified, to vote for a different Republican, not Hillary. We tried to make that very clear. Not Hillary. We get that you're not going to do that. But
now just to be clear, the plan at that point would be, if you got enough Republicans to defect, to vote for anybody else whatsoever, it would throw it into the House.
Correct. And actually, there's an interesting piece of that. People would think that each House of Representative member would get a vote.
Nope.
They don't. It's actually each individual state delegation. Right. So Wyoming, one congressperson gets a vote. California's 43 or 47 get one vote. Here's the other interesting thing. You have to get a majority. So if one person gets 24 delegations, another one gets 24, and one gets two, nobody's president.
And you have to keep voting. Yes. And there are also restrictions. Like, they have to vote from the top three electoral college voters.
Correct. Now, do you know how the vice president works in that case?
It's the Senate picks the vice president. Correct.
And it's five choices.
Right.
The top five choices. And here's the crazy thing. If nobody reaches a majority after, say, days of voting in the House of Representatives, but the Senate has picked a vice presidential candidate,
then that can become the president.
Correct. And now, I mean, this is all way down the line, but that was our goal. We wanted to show the House of Representatives, hey, if you guys agree with us that this guy is unqualified, we're giving you another option that respects the party of the people who won the election in the Electoral College.
Yeah, because if you went through that process, right? I mean, first of all, you throw it into the House. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the most likely outcome there is the Republicans controlled the number of House delegations they needed. They had over 25. So if the Republicans in the House stayed true to Donald Trump, they would still elect Donald Trump in that scenario. But you are giving them the option, potentially, mm-hmm. by putting a second Republican on their choice list, that they could pick that person instead.
Yeah, like Mitt Romney, someone who had already been vetted, that the American people are very familiar with and many voted for.
Right.
So in a case where someone like Mitt Romney got put in, it really could be an opportunity for them to say, okay, this guy's been vetted. That's a long shot. The whole thing was a long shot, because even in that first day where we were starting everything, we knew it was a Hail Mary.
Right.
We knew it was a long shot. We knew we would get death threats. We knew we might be thrown out of the party. And we also knew that if we succeeded, our lives would probably be forfeit. Because there are violent people who support Trump. Not all of them, but there is a group that are. So I had plans to leave the country if we had succeeded, to get out.
Wow.
Yeah, I had to. I also had to boot my family for a period of time because of the death threats against them. Because it had gotten pretty big. But I've talked about all that stuff in super, super depth. So did you want to start moving on to the court case stuff? Or do you want to stay here?
Let's keep going. I'm okay spending a little bit more time on this. Okay. So you made the decision that you were going to do this along with this other elector from Colorado.
Michael Baca,
sorry. That's and right. And then how did your effort to recruit people go?
So once we had kind of spun up the organization, one of the biggest problems early on was that there was 70 or 100 groups kind of trying to reach out to electors and mm-hmm. send mails. And about 10% of the things they communicated with the electors with were threats. Mm. And that's not going to change anybody's mind. And so our first thing was, hey, people, please stop. Don't reach out to these folks unless you're saying, hey, we love you. Please stand up for your country.
I remember hearing all sorts of commentary specifically from Republican electors talking about how they were getting threats, talking about how people were trying to intimidate them and tell them not to vote for Donald Trump, and specifically how many of them were telling them that they should vote for Hillary Clinton because she won the popular vote and things like that. And many of these Republican electors were like, you know, whatever else is going on, because I'm getting harassed this way, there's no way I'm considering anything other than voting for Donald Trump.
That's correct. And I had personal conversations with at least 150 Republican electors. It was hard to get through to some of them, but I'll tell you, and I'm not going to give any names or even states, but there are entire state delegations that loathe Trump as a human being. Mm. You know, there's a particularly religious state, for example. And every single one of their electors loathed Donald Trump as a human being because of his comments about grabbing people by their privates and, you know, essentially sexually assaulting people. That's completely an anathema to what those people believe. And we did. We about 2 weeks in, out of the 40 days between general election and the Electoral College vote, we got our first flip, which was Chris Suprin, a gentleman from Texas, who took a stand, decided to come out in the New York Times.
Now I remember Chris, and I believe there was, you know, another Republican elector that came out later as well.
In the end,
In the end. Now, and it wasn't clear to me at the time whether those Republican electors who did defect, whether they were specifically associating themselves with your effort or whether they were doing that completely independently. Were they connected with you?
Suprin is completely connected to us, and I'm proud to call him a fellow Hamilton elector.
Okay.
And the other gentleman we had certainly spoken with, we had certainly reached out to, we had certainly kind of – one of the things I tried to do is make sure they understood their rights under the Electoral College. As opposed to telling them do this, I was telling – I was explaining to them, hey, depending on how you feel about Donald Trump, as opposed to someone like Mitt Romney, you absolutely have these rights. Here's Federalist 68. Give it a read. See what you think. And it was more about trying to educate them about their options than saying, gosh darn it, you need to vote for Mitt Romney or John Kasich or else you're horrible. It was just about saying, hey, you may not know this. A lot of us didn't know this. So take a look. So I think the second gentleman may have been someone who he wasn't directly associated with us, but we had certainly had conversations with him.
Okay. So in the end, There were some electors in some states that attempted to do things and failed, and we'll talk about them in a second.
Sure.
In terms of the ones that were actually certified in the end, there were 7, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think that sounds right.
And so the votes were 3 for Powell, 1 for Kasich, 1 for Paul, 1 for Sanders, and 1 for Spotted Eagle.
Correct.
And one of the questions I had at the time was, it seemed like you guys made a distinct choice not to mandate which person this group was going to get behind. Like, you weren't all saying, yeah, okay, we're all going to go for Mitt Romney. And so you ended up with a whole bunch of people going in different directions. And I kind of wondered at the time whether or not you would have had more success if you had been able to identify a person who you could all sort of point together, and even better, if you could actually get someone to say, I accept and I'm happy with these electors voting for me. And maybe that was just plain impossible. What was the story behind that?
So I'm not going to give you everything here because some of this is private. However, yeah, I will say this. I think any organization like ours would have clearly been reaching out to the 4 or 5 campaigns at the top of our list on a very regular basis. Mm-hmm. Any organization like ours would have been crazy not to do that. And here's the problem. Without getting their permission, if we came out, let's say 2 weeks in, and said, hey, we're backing Mitt Romney. We want Mitt Romney. Everybody vote for Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Well, that puts him in a position where he has to come out. He's going to be asking by media constantly, what do you think? Will you accept it? Do you think they should do this? And so
more than likely, if he was put in that scenario, he'd say no. Yeah.
So our only choice at that point, our only strategic choice, as unfortunate it was, to leave it open-minded while still mentioning some good options. You know, my favorite was Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice, but I think John Kasich would have done fine, and so would Mitt Romney.
In the end, I believe you did vote for Colin Powell, correct?
Personally. Yes, and I can tell you the story about how we came upon Colin Powell, if you like.
Sure.
So fast forward to Electoral College Day.
Yeah.
By the time it had gotten to Washington State's time to vote, we already know we had failed.
Right.
Just because of the counts.
So given you already knew you failed, why did you go through with it anyway?
Because our whole thing the entire time through was telling the Republicans, who thought it was a trick to get Hillary in, we need to make this clear, this isn't a trick. So we're going to vote for Republicans too.
Okay.
Because honestly, at that point, it was only a spiritual or philosophical benefit to vote for Hillary. It didn't harm her in the least bits. And I understand it hurt some people's feelings, but
Not all of the electors were apparently with you then on that, because, you know, we had a vote for Sanders. That wasn't part of your plan.
Oh, no, not at all. The guy who voted for Sanders, we never spoke with. He never spoke with us. He expressed no interest or never reached out to. Because, I mean, most of our focus was on Republican electors. We wanted a few Democratic electors. But another Democratic elector wasn't going to really help because it had to be Republicans.
Yes.
So when it came down to that day, and we're sitting there after having, you know, the little tea with the Secretary of State in the Capitol building, Levi Guerra, who's 18 years old at the time, she's currently in the Marines, one of the most amazing women I've ever met in my life, and I think she's going to be a senator or president one day. You mark my words, you can mark this timestamp. and Esther Little Dove John, an older African-American Quaker educated at Yale and a community activist and radio producer. Those were my two other Hamilton electors in Washington State. We sat and we just said, hey, so who do we vote for? And Esther Little Dove John says, what about Colin Powell? I think he's the one I respect the most. And Levi and I are like, yep, that's how we feel too. So, you know, we decided to go for Colin Powell at that time. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and who did you vote for vice president?
So we decided that we needed to make it clear that this was an issue of us having any issues with female politicians. This wasn't, I mean, my two fellow Hamilton electors were both, are both, you know, women of color. And we didn't want people to see us as like trying to take away something from a woman. And so we all decided like, hey, let's vote for the vice president for the, you know, the qualified woman for vice president that we respect the most. So, Levi Guerra voted for our Washington state senator, Maria Cantwell. Esther voted for Susan Collins. She believes she should vote Republican for both in that case. And I placed my vice presidential vote for Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Okay. So you did, you went to, through the electoral call, the vote, you did this. Tell me the stories of some of the people who tried. You obviously succeeded in doing your vote not for the candidate you were quote unquote supposed to. Mm-hmm. There were electors in various states that were stopped.
Yep.
Can you tell us the story of some of those?
So there's some outliers, and I don't have much background on those, but Colorado is the crucial one.
Okay.
The other ones didn't actually come into play in any of the lawsuits or anything like that. They just happened and then they were gone. So in Colorado, there were three electors that were part of Hamilton Electors. Michael Baca, the co-founder of Hamilton Electors. Polly Baca, an amazing woman. She was the first woman and the first Latina to be elected to the Colorado State House and the Colorado State Senate. So it was just an honor for her to come on board. And then Robert, I'm going to butcher his last name, but Nemanik. Something like that. And I don't know a ton of his background. So in Colorado, their state law says, and keep in mind, 2016 was the first time in the history of the United States where any elector was penalized by a state law for voting outside of who they're quote unquote supposed to.
Right. Because so, this had happened. There have been faithless electors about every third election or so, yep, going back forever. And usually it's a non-event. I mean, I believe one time it even happened by accident.
It did. And they couldn't figure out who it was because that they voted in secret.
Yeah.
That was Minnesota.
And every time it's happened, it hasn't made any difference and no one's really followed up. But because it's happened a few times and states didn't really want it to happen, a few states have passed laws to try to prevent it.
More than half, 30 at this point. So the two laws in question that are going to be crucial when we talk about the court cases is Washington state law, which says that an elector can be fined up to $1,000 if they don't vote for the correct person. Now, the interesting fact there, this is a little fun fact. So the reason that law was created, it was created, I want to say, 1974.
Okay.
And there was an elector named Mike Padden. He was a Republican elector. And instead of voting for Gerald Ford, like he was supposed to, he was a Ronald Reagan guy. So in the 70s, he placed his electoral vote for Ronald Reagan. A little bit of a follow-up. So he was Washington State's first, quote, faithless elector. He went on to serve in the Washington State House for, I think, 4 or 5 terms. And he's currently serving 4 or 5 terms in the state Senate.
Okay.
And so that's Washington state laws. Colorado law.
Just curious. Did you talk to him as part of this process?
He never had any interest in discussing it with me, but there is a little follow up when it comes to 2018, and there was a law change in Washington state.
Okay.
But Colorado's law was
so,
that.
So just to summarize on Washington state didn't put in any place to anything to directly stop you,
correct,
but would fine you if correct you did the wrong thing.
Correct.
$1,000.
Yes. Up to.
Up to.
And in Colorado, and this is a much more common law than the Washington state one. But in Colorado, they have a law that basically says as soon as someone tries to vote for the quote incorrect candidate, their ballot will be destroyed. And they will be replaced on the spot by a vote of the remaining electors.
And just off the top of my head, when I was hearing about all of these different laws, you know, on the one that's a fine, my immediate reaction was, well, okay, fine. There's a fine. They can't stop the vote though. The vote will be there. The vote will count. And whether or not there's a fine is kind of almost beside the point. If you know, maybe, you know, it's still, there's a principle there, right? But they can't stop the vote.
Yeah.
Whereas in the case of what you're describing for Colorado, it's like they actually already made the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, it seems like it should be too late to stop anything.
It should be too late before that.
And there were other states, I believe, that you said there were some that didn't proceed to a lawsuit. And I believe in those cases, there were some where the elector had publicly stated their intention, yes, to do something different before the vote. Correct. And so they were replaced before, yep, the vote. And both, you know, and I think these things to me seemed like they were on a spectrum of badness, you know. Whereas I don't like any of those three, to be clear. I really believe in the notion of, if you're going to have an electoral college, they should be free agents. But in the spectrum of badness, I think the fine is the least bad, but then the next is the, you know, replace them before, because at least you can just, in that case, shut up. Don't say anything. If you intend to do something different, just do it at the very last minute, but don't give any warning, and you can still vote however you want. And then, but the worst of the three seems to be the Colorado situation, where the elector actually makes their vote, and then they rip it up.
Well, the interesting thing in that case, so Colorado, and I agree with you for the most part, except I would argue that all three of them have chilling effects and also go against what the Constitution says. But we'll find out.
I agree that they are all chilling. They're all bad. I'm just putting them on a spectrum of badness.
Sure, 100%. I 100% agree with you. But one of the arguments the Washington State Attorney General, who I love, the Washington State Attorney General, but one of the things their argument was $1,000 isn't enough to be a big deal. Mm. And my argument is a penny would still be unconstitutional.
Right.
But to get back to the Colorado day of the, yeah, Electoral College vote. So Michael Baca, Polly Baca, no relation, by the way. Apparently Baca is a common name in Colorado.
Okay.
And the other gentleman, they all sat down to vote. The Colorado Secretary of State, who seems rather unhinged to me, as opposed to our Secretary of State, who I disagree with policy-wise, but was very polite and reasonable and cordial. He had been threatening that anybody who did this would be charged with perjury and sent for criminal prosecution.
Right. That seems even more excessive.
Yes, and I think probably illegal. But they actually pre-printed the ballots to say Hillary Clinton and Kane, as opposed to Washington State, where they're blank because we're supposed to be voting. As soon as Michael Baca crossed out Hillary Clinton and put in Kasich, they took the ballot from him, and the Secretary of State removed him immediately, told him he was probably going to be sending him for prosecution, and replaced him. Now, here's the crazy thing. Polly Baca and the other gentleman had every intention of voting for John Kasich. They were scared. And so they did as they were told by the Secretary of State, because he was threatening criminal prosecution for them voting and taking their constitutional duty. That's what happened on election night.
And so out of these, I guess let's fast forward now to the lawsuits.
Yes.
There was one lawsuit in Washington State that you were directly involved in, and then one in Colorado, because these are the two places where,
yes,
your group was either fined or stopped from voting. As you said, there were a couple other attempts at faithless electors elsewhere that didn't end up being lawsuits. I believe a couple of them intended to vote for Sanders and some other stuff. But so these two lawsuits, let's talk about Washington State first.
Okay.
And then we can move on to Colorado, where the new developments happened this week.
Perfect. So I'll give one clear difference I want to make right up front. Washington State, we were fined. So we appealed. So we are the appellants. In the Colorado case, they were never sent for prosecution.
Mm.
So they were never charged with anything. He was just removed. So in that case, they sued the state of Colorado. So that is actually going to come to be an important point later on.
Okay.
So the Washington State case, from day one, We had a plan to test for some amazing pro bono lawyers who had worked with us in an attempted injunction earlier. The noted constitutional scholar, Lawrence Lessig, came on board for both cases. Obviously, with Washington state lawyers and Colorado lawyers dealing, you know, with the main arguments, and Lawrence Lessig being given permission to argue because he's not in the bar in either Washington or Colorado. So the Washington state case, we went through an administrative hearing, and they cannot consider constitutional issues. So we lost that case as we had to. The next level was the first state appellate court. Now, we argued for a half an hour, an hour between the two groups, and the judge issued a one-sentence verbal opinion a half an hour later. She said, the appellants have not proven their case. Now, what that says to me is, since she's an elected judge, she didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, and it was going to go up to the next level either way. So she basically played kick the can. The attorney general then, with the agreement of our legal team, reached out to the attorney general's office and said, hey, how about we save the taxpayers of Washington state some money and just skip ahead straight to the state Supreme Court and skip the next appellate level, because we know it's going to the state Supreme Court either way. And so we skipped the next level, and then we got to be heard in front of the Washington state Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the key thing. We didn't need to win.
Okay.
We needed a single dissenting opinion to have a good chance of going to the U.S. Supreme Court. And during the questioning, it was very clear that most of the justices either weren't understanding or weren't accepting or weren't considering our pretty clear constitutional arguments.
Just to be clear, like, you're convinced they didn't understand as opposed to they did understand and disagreed?
I think there was a mix. They're all intelligent justices, but I will say this. All of them are elected. We're one of the only states in the entire country that have an elected Supreme Court. So that does add some judgment into that. There's a reason most states don't have elected Supreme Courts. There's a reason our national Supreme Court isn't elected. So I think it was a mix. Because I believe that if you look at the Constitution and you look at the precedent, that it states that this should at least be considered. And it didn't feel like a lot of the justices were even truly considering it. Now, that's just my perspective. I'm not saying I'm right. It was just how I felt sitting in the room.
Right. So you needed one dissent. Now, why did you need the one dissent? Does that make it easier to appeal further?
100% that. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to say, hey, wait a minute. We think this needs to continue to be looked at. There was a justice who totally saw what we were saying. So maybe we need a larger organization to do this. So, but we had to wait for the Colorado case, because that was basically, at that point, the end of our case. Now, we technically did file with the Supreme Court of the United States to let them know we were planning on filing an appeal with them.
Okay.
So that happened. Now,
why did you have to wait for the Colorado case?
We didn't have to, but here's the deal. Let's say the Colorado case came in, and it was 0-3. The state can totally stop electors. It's totally cool. Well, that makes it a really uphill battle, because two different high courts have determined that the state has the right to do this. Mm. However, if what did happen, which is we're fast forwarding to like 3 days ago, is the 10th District Appeals Court decided in a 2-1 verdict that Michael Baca's constitutional rights were taken away from him by being removed, and the Secretary of State was 100% wrong in removing him.
And this sets up a fundamental, even though the specific laws were different, this sets up a disagreement between two different courts that can then be resolved by the Supreme Court.
Exactly. That's 100% it. And there are a lot of ways that the Supreme Court can handle it. They can combine our cases, they can hear our case, but also consider the precedent set by the 10th Circuit Court. There's a lot of different ways that this permutation could land. But either way, one of these cases or both of these cases is at this point almost inevitably going to be in front of the Supreme Court in the first 6 months of next year.
To be clear, the Supreme Court could also decline to hear it at all.
Yes, but let's be honest. This is an outstanding question on a core portion of the Constitution. We literally don't have an answer about how we can elect our president. I would bet 100-1 that the Supreme Court is going to take it, because this question needs to be answered. And that's what I tell to people who totally disagree with me. I say at this point, we need to have an answer. We need to know if this is okay or not. We cannot stay in limbo.
Now, you may be right that they may take it for that reason, but they could also say the time to hear this is if and when these kinds of faithless electors ever actually make a difference in an election result.
Honestly, with the legal theory that's going on here, and Lawrence Lessig, who again is a worldwide constitutional expert, that's pretty unlikely. Given there's a 140-page opinion for the District 10,
right? And also, I'll say, just from a practical point of view, you don't want to be making that decision in the 3 weeks between the Electoral College voting and the inauguration of a new president or whatever, you know?
So I guess it's a little bit more than
3 weeks, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. So I think you're right that technically, yes, they could do one of those things, but I think it's incredibly unlikely, because that would mean that the five or six states under the 10th Circuit Court cannot enforce their state laws, mm-hmm. but every other state in the country can.
Right.
And that is not a really great place to be in electing our president. And I think the Supreme Court, all of them, will understand that, regardless of their political leanings.
And would rather resolve this kind of issue before we get to the next election.
Yes, and most ideally. Likely it'll probably happen in February, March, or April.
That would be the hearing of the case.
Yes. Yes.
Now, they're sometimes slow in actually producing results. So we're skipping ahead a little bit. So tell me a little bit more. The Colorado case came out in favor of the elector, as you said. What was the rationale? Because I know there was some question about whether or not it was even a moot point.
Yes. And okay. So there's 60 pages of them determining if the electors had standing, basically the right to take this case.
And they determined that the one elector who was actually turned out had standing. The two that decided not to break the rules did not have standing, because in the end, their votes were not taken away. They were just sort of intimidated into doing something different than they were going to.
It's not even that simple.
I can believe it. I've got the opinion up on my screen right now, and I'm scrolling through the hundreds of pages here.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yes, there's lots of complexity here. I'm oversimplifying. Yes,
very much so. But fair enough for the sake of, that's essentially what it is. And they also had to determine whether there's any standing for damages.
Right.
And they determined again that the two other electors didn't have standing for damages, and Michael Baca did.
Because one of the issues there is you can't remedy the actual vote, right?
Nope,
I mean, it's way, way, way too late for that. So what's the harm that was done here? You can't suddenly go back and say, okay, now you can have your Electoral College vote. Too late. So he was trying to get monetary damage from the state. And so there was a question of, did that even make sense?
That's not the only thing. I forget how it's phrased in the opinion, but it essentially has something to do with redressing the facts of the case before. I'd have to 10 minutes to read it to give you the exact example. But the dollar amount that they're asking is $1.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not Michael Baca's not trying to extract a bunch of money.
He's not trying to get rich off this.
No, it's literally a dollar. Basically, it's a nominal damages, but it's the point that we're finding you a dollar because you were wrong, and we want to make it clear that you were wrong. And in the end, they believe that Michael Baca's constitutional rights were harmed, that he has the ability to recover a dollar, have a one. He's not even going to get the dollar. It's going to go to some fund. Mm-hmm. and the record will be corrected. Now, I don't recall the exact wording, but there is another way that it will be redressed. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. So Colorado can still appeal this to the Supreme Court, but it's unlikely they will. In our Washington state case, we still have the absolute right to appeal.
So Colorado is likely to just say, okay, here's the dollar or whatever.
Most likely, although their Secretary of State has said some pretty inflammatory stuff. Mm-hmm. So they may do the illogical thing and appeal, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Okay.
But the Washington State case is clear. We absolutely have the right to appeal.
And the fact that – and this result in Colorado strengthens your case.
By a million times over. And it also creates a direct conflict in the law. And what we're looking at when we go there, I'm a progressive. I'm a Democrat. And what's funny is the conservative justices may be the one who support my case. Mm. Because our case is, at its heart, originalist. It's constitutionally originalist.
Yeah, because you're saying, look, the original intent of the Electoral College was as a deliberative body. You're electing electors to pick the president.
Yep.
That's how it was supposed to be. All of this other layering on top of it and winner take all states and all this kind of stuff is additional stuff on top of it that perverts the original intent.
I wouldn't even say perverts. It doesn't change it at all. Mm. Because none of that changes what the Constitution says in black and white.
Right.
And that's the bottom line. The states are arguing that we've done it for this long this way. So how can we change it now? Well, the real fact is it's never been changed.
Yeah, I saw a headline. I forget if it was NBC or somebody saying this changes the way we do elections. And I'm like, it doesn't change anything. This is actually validating the way it's supposed to be.
Exactly. You're 100% correct. And here's the weird thing. This is almost unique in constitutional law. There's almost no part of the Constitution that hasn't been tested in the Supreme Court of the U.S. and state courts. Numerous times. This is almost unique.
Interestingly enough, one of the other ones is the Emoluments Clause.
Correct.
Go ahead.
The only case law that exists directly having to do with Electoral College is Ray versus Blair from the 50s, where a bunch of Alabama people against Democrats against desegregation didn't want to vote for their party bearer.
Right.
So they said, let's give them a pledge. They need to vote for their party bearer. And they took them to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, might have been the Alabama Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't remember which one. But they said, the pledges are 100% constitutional. It's a part of the job interview. And the Constitution gives the states the right to the job interview. But guess what? They also said, however,
the electors can violate the pledge.
Basically, they said if the state tried to penalize the electors for violating the pledge, that probably would be completely unconstitutional.
Right. So in other words, you could have people jump through whatever hoops you wanted before you selected them as an elector.
Yep.
Including promising to vote in a certain way. But once they are given the role of elector and that's all certified, you no longer have any control. They can change their mind. They can violate their pledges. They can do whatever they want.
Yes, exactly. And so that's like basically the only direct precedent for it. So another one we used for precedent was I don't remember which state, but the state legislator had chosen the senator to go to Washington, D.C. And the senator went to Washington, D.C. and voted for something in complete opposition of what the state legislator wanted. Mm. So the state legislator tried to fire them and say, well, hey, we appointed you. We have the right to tell you how to vote. And the Supreme Court said, no, you don't. You have the right to choose who this person is.
You can't get rid of them.
But then they're serving a federal function. And the state does not have the right to affect someone doing a federal function. And we very much think electors are the same thing.
Right.
Now, we're not technically federal officials, but we are committing a federal function, and states cannot do that. And I do want to make something very clear. We all took our pledges very seriously, and we had to balance the moral, ethical, legal, and frankly, the damage Donald Trump could do in making this decision, and none of us took it lightly. None of us just went, ah, screw the pledge. Who cares? Doesn't matter. It matters a lot.
Yeah, because just to be clear, I mean, even observing here, because I know, you know, one of the reasons I'm able to talk to you here is both you and my wife are involved in local politics here in Washington State and Snohomish County. And I've heard directly in a number of cases, either sometimes being present at some of these events and sometimes just hearing via my wife, frankly, you get a lot of shit.
I do.
For what you did, from a lot of people who are like, you know, you win against the pledge. You did not vote for the Democrat. Why? You just get lots of hassle for this decision and lots of people who think you were fundamentally wrong and were betraying the Democratic Party and all of this kind of thing. But, you know, I think you've explained very well your logic and why you did what you did. It certainly sounds like you took this very seriously. This is not something where you were, like you said, you're not like, screw everybody, we're just going to play with it. And, you know, there have been faithless electors in the past who have sort of done it in for less serious reasons or just for the hell of it or, you know, to make some sort of protest statement. And, and to some degree, you know, look, you could make the argument, and you addressed this earlier, of once it was clear it just wasn't going to work, why didn't you just say, okay, well, I guess we're voting for Hillary Clinton after all, because we didn't get the Republicans we needed to. But what you were trying to do, you had a rationale behind it. Now, I remember at the time in 2016 watching you and your other Hamilton electors go through the process and thinking right along, yeah, there's no way this is going to work.
Well, we knew it was a long shot.
But it was an interesting approach, and I think it was one that you know, actually built awareness of, like, look, this is what the Electoral College really is.
Yep.
And you mentioned you're against the Electoral College. You would prefer to have a national popular vote, I take it.
Not the national popular vote compact. I believe the only way to truly solve it is to have an amendment to the Constitution.
Right. I wasn't saying the national popular vote compact.
Okay. Apologies.
You would like a national popular vote of some sort, rather than having electors in the Electoral College. But as long as you have them, look, they were there for a reason, and they were intended to be people who exercise judgment. And as you said, the Federalist specifically talks about the kind of scenario we were having in 2016, and that this would be a firewall against something crazy happening. And because the one of the things the founders very much, they didn't trust democracy. Nope. There were so many layers put in place, not just the electors, but in other parts of the government as well, to basically protect the country against the whims of pure democracy. And this was one of them.
I completely agree. And when it comes down to, you know, exposing it and showing it, that was basically the second biggest thing we wanted to do. First of all, we wanted to explain to people, this is an emergency. The metaphor I used the most was those breaking case of glass alarms, you know, the ones in schools or civil buildings, where, you know, you have a little hammer and you break the glass if there's a true emergency.
Right.
We truly believe that that's what we were trying to do. The founding fathers left it for us. But here's the thing. It had gotten dusty. It was covered. Nobody had seen it for years. Everybody forgot about it. But it was still right there in the Constitution. It hadn't changed. It hadn't changed at all. It was still right there, and we chose to attempt to pull it.
Right. So, okay. So just to I guess, wrap this up.
Sure.
You now, given this, you're full speed ahead to go to the Supreme Court. You're in the process of filing the next set of papers.
Yeah.
And you said, sometime in this late winter or early spring, you expect the next stage of this stuff?
Well, I guess winter's February. So, or in the first two quarters of next year.
Okay. And then are you thinking you'd actually get to the point of a result in 2020 before the next election? I know the Supreme Court tends to be rather slow in many cases.
We're convinced. My legal team, and I don't want to speak for all of them, but from what I'm hearing, they all believe that if the court takes the case, they're doing it with the understanding that there's a presidential right around the corner and we need to understand it. So we believe they will issue a result probably months and months before, well, a few months before the general election, at least.
Okay. And obviously you hope you're going to win.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this is a slam dunk case? Do you think this is going to be something that really could go in any way, depending on what the Supreme Court justices are thinking at the moment or what?
It's going to be a nail biter. We have the best lawyer literally in the world who will be arguing this case for this case. You know, maybe there's a better DUI lawyer out there or something, but, you know, the best lawyer in the world to handle a constitutional law case is the one who's going to be arguing for us. But here's the thing. You've got the Democrat. You've got the liberal leaning justices who might understand that it's undemocratic and want to fight against it. But really, we'll probably win if we get the conservative justices, because again, they're originalists. And since there's been no precedent set other than Roe versus Blair, which really wasn't that big of a precedent, I think we have a good chance of winning. It's not a long shot like the plan to stop Trump was.
Right.
I think this is – I'm giving us maybe 60-40 odds of winning.
Okay.
But it's early. It's early to have really hard numbers though.
Now, do you think depending on the results of this case, do you think it makes any difference towards efforts for the future to change the Electoral College in the first place, or – does it all wash? Like, if you win, if you lose, I mean, there's so much inertia behind the Electoral College. I mean, you know, a constitutional amendment is such a heavy lift. I mean,
agreed.
Frankly, the National Popular Vote Compact that you mentioned, which for those who don't know, is a bunch of states who are passing state laws that say that if enough states agree to that, then all of those states together, if they have 270 electoral votes or more, will agree to all go by whatever the national popular vote is, and they've got a ways to go. But that, frankly, that's less of a lift to get there than to actually do a constitutional amendment.
Correct. But let's say we win, and all those 30 state laws are considered unconstitutional.
Right.
Well, then both Republican and Democratic electors will realize that they do have the choice.
And they can do whatever they want.
And I hope they don't do whatever they want. I hope they do what they think is best for their constituents and for the country. Mm-hmm. I that's what I think they should be doing and what I tried to do. But
theoretically,
I think that exposes
just to be clear, theoretically, yeah. It means that all 538 electors could say, we don't care about what happened in the election at all. We're all going to pick our favorite people and we'll go from there.
100%. And here's the beauty. Here's the beauty of that. That exposes the Electoral College to the entire country is exactly what it is. You mentioned the headline earlier where it said change the way we elect presidents. Journalists don't even understand that this is the way it's been done since the 12th Amendment was written. So the American people certainly don't know. And why would they? They're busy with living their lives and doing their jobs and concentrating on presidential candidates. They're not spending 30 hours investigating the history of the Electoral College. I don't blame them. But this would expose it. This would show the American people there is zero question now. This is an undemocratic institution. And here's the thing. Let's say we get the National Voters Compact. And let's say 271 electoral votes. In those states. So it's going to be 271 to 269. Well, there's still two electors that could flip, completely flip into the other contest.
Yes.
So it's still a completely undemocratic.
I mean, the scenario people always bring up as the nightmare scenario is, you know, forget the National Popular Vote Compact. You just end up with a 269-269 tie. Any single elector deciding to do something different either flips the result of the election. Well, I guess it's a tie. So any single elector could put the other side over the edge if they wanted, or vote for a third person and throw it to the House. I mean, it's already in the House if it's 269, 269.
Exactly.
But any one or two electors could, by changing what they do, change the result of the election. And it's up to those one or two or three particular electors who want to do this. Also, you know, there are other things in place of like, what are the rules around like how they're, you know, can you bribe them? Can you offer them like a deal of some sort? What are you allowed or not allowed to do to influence these electors? There's all kinds of additional nightmare scenarios in there.
In Federalist Papers in the Senate debate, it made it very clear that money or those kind of deals should never happen.
Right.
And it's actually interesting. One of the reasons, I want to hit this because I didn't make it clear earlier. When we chose to vote for the Republican candidate, one of the things we were trying to show is that there's still people in this country who could put country before party.
Right.
If they believe they're really fighting for the right thing. And when it comes to the National Voters Compact, really at the end of the day, it's slightly better because it'll probably result in the popular vote being honored much more, but it's still completely undemocratic. I mean, it's closer.
You still have the underlying structure of the electors, exactly. And they are still potentially independent entities because if you win, then all of those electors are still free agents and can still do whatever they want. And there's still the potential for chaos. Now, I guess if you lose, then something like that, then all of the states could potentially pass laws that make the Electoral College essentially automatic.
Correct.
And say, forget the individuals in this role. That's just a ceremonial nonsense. The bottom line is we have winner take all, or the congressional district thing that Maine and Nebraska have, or something else. But the state would determine, here is the procedure whereby our electoral votes are allocated, and no human electors would have any influence in that.
Yeah.
And I suspect if you lose, it'll go from just over a majority of the states to nearly all of them passing laws like that.
I agree, but that also brings up the question at that point. If they're just automatically giving the votes, you've taken away half the reason the Founding Fathers created the Electoral College, and I think it weakens the argument for keeping it.
Right. The other half, beyond the personal judgment of the electors, being just like the Senate versus the House, being another way to balance the influence of small states versus large states and all of this that, you know, originally was rooted very much in, you know, slave states versus non-states as well. And that was the other part of it.
Exactly. And frankly, I don't believe that an individual voting Wyoming's vote should count 43 times more than someone voting in California. It may have made sense when we had 13 colonies and X, I don't even know what the population was then, but pretty small. It might have made sense then. It makes zero sense now.
I mean, a lot of it was also part of the compromises needed to create the country in the first place. Like, without these compromises that gave the more rural states balancing power against the more developed urban states, there just wouldn't have been a United States of America. It would have fallen apart.
Yep.
And because it was clear that the Articles of Confederation were failing, and this is what they needed to do to keep going.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean it's like the ideal for all time. It's what they needed at the time to move forward.
So, yeah, how many things have we changed 200 years ago, 100 years ago that were crucial to that deal? The 3/5 rule, mm-hmm. only white landowning males being able to vote. We've changed so many things that were required for those compromise. Why should the Electoral College be any different if it's something that is outdated and unnecessary?
Right. So I guess we're pretty much at the end here. I just wanted to thank you very much for joining us. This was a great conversation. It went longer than I'd originally planned, but I think it was very instructive for me. I'm glad to have finally talked to you about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's an important question, and I'll be watching your Supreme Court battle carefully, and I'd love it if after it's all over, you could come back and talk to us again.
I'll certainly do what I can, and I look forward to talking to you when myself and your wife are on the local fire commission.
Yes, both of you specifically are running for fire commissioner in part of our county. And so good luck to both of you, I guess.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Brett. And, you know, it was great talking to you. And we'll talk again someday.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Facebook, Facebook, Facebook! Hey, do you want to help support Curmudgeon's Corner? Well, right now, the best way is through Facebook. If you haven't already liked us on Facebook and you actually, well, like us, then go search for Curmudgeon's Corner on Facebook and like our page. It will help you see when we announce new episodes, and it'll help us reach more new people too. If you like a particular episode, like our episode announcement post too, or share it with your friends. All of this helps spread the word about our podcast to more people who might like it as well. And of course, we love having a conversation with all of you listeners, so please use Facebook to leave comments on the shows, give us suggestions, or anything else like that. It's always great to hear from you. So if you want to help the show, use Facebook. Or forget all of that and just send us money.
And that was that. I hope you all enjoyed that interview with Brett Schifalo. Like I said at the beginning of the show, I was very interested. I find this stuff fascinating. I find what Brett did here fascinating. I know a lot of people have given him and his effort a really hard time. But I actually think it was an important thing to do for a variety of reasons, even though, you know, as he himself said, they knew it was a real long shot and they probably weren't going to be able to convince enough Republicans to change the result of the 2016 election. But it was an important effort, I think. It brings to light things about the Electoral College, and, you know, they tried to do what they thought was right. And I hope that came through in our conversation. In any case, fascinating stuff. Hope you enjoyed it. So now the usual end of show stuff. Thank you for joining us on Curmudgeon's Corner. As usual, you can find us all over the place. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/curmudgeonscorner for all the latest episodes. You can comment there, give us feedback there. If you want to send feedback to us directly, feedback@curmudgeons-corner.com. And if you want to get a message to Brett, let me know through that email address and I will pass it along to Brett. And if you really like the show, patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner, you can give us a little tip, and at various levels, we'll mention you on the show. You can get a postcard, you can get a mug. And of course, at $2 a month or more, you can get invited to our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, where we're talking all week long about the news, about various interesting things we've seen, about whatever random stuff we feel like, with myself, Yvonne, a whole bunch of the sometimes co-hosts of the show, and some other listeners, listeners like you. And in addition to the Patreon donation, if you interact with us on Facebook or through feedback or whatever, we'll happily invite you to the Slack as well. It's a lot of fun. And aside from that, I'm on Twitter at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E. And leave us reviews on iTunes and other places where you can review podcasts. I think I got it all. Next week, we should be back with a normal show, unless something really unexpected happens. But again, I hope you enjoyed the interview today. A little bit different for us, but I thought it was a lot of fun. I hope you thought it was interesting, too. Thank you, and have a great week. Goodbye.